This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Dave Mistich. We'll hear from a veteran reporter who covers the environment about the struggling system that makes sure that mining sites are cleaned up.
If you, the mining company, are going to mine, you make money available that should theoretically cover the cost of cleanup. If you walk away without cleaning up, the state has that money available. These are called bonds.
That story and more on this West Virginia Morning. A month after passing a resolution strongly encouraging Shepherdstown businesses to require face masks inside their establishments, the town council is formally calling on Governor Jim Justice to mandate face masks in public spaces across West Virginia. Liz McCormick reports.
The Shepherdstown Town Council on Tuesday passed the resolution requesting Justice make wearing masks a requirement. Shepherdstown Mayor Jim Oxer said during the meeting held via the video conferencing app Zoom that masks help limit the spread of the coronavirus, according to health officials. And he pointed to the governor's frequent call for citizens to wear masks when out in public.
It is divisive, but maybe if he hears from constituents about how we feel about that, maybe it'll help him make a decision. If he really feels that's important, then we're helping him do that.
Of the council members present on the Zoom call, only one person spoke against the resolution, saying requiring masks goes too far. While Justice has urged West Virginians to wear masks in public, he has not made it mandatory and insists if he did so, it would cause division and tread on people's freedoms. In late May, the Shepherdstown Town Council passed a resolution that strongly encourages businesses in town to require face masks of their customers. The resolution was also accompanied by a letter from the Shepherdstown Police Department saying businesses have the option to get police involved if someone refuses to wear a mask and enters a business anyway. The person could even be subject to a trespassing charge. Some states in the country have mandated wearing masks in public places, such as Maryland, California, and some cities in Arizona, but largely it is only a recommendation in the United States. The Eastern Panhandle has consistently seen high numbers of positive coronavirus cases. Berkeley County has held the highest number of cases in the state for several weeks. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Federal data shows coal production in the Ohio Valley has decreased by nearly 50% since 2009. COVID-19 has flattened energy demand, striking another blow to the already struggling industry. Bankruptcies keep piling up. As the market shrinks, reporter Mark Oliday says the systems put in place to make sure coal mines are cleaned up are in jeopardy. Oliday has been covering the issue for years. In his latest investigative piece, he explores how the bonding programs and insurance companies backing millions of dollars in cleanup obligations are on the brink. He spoke with reporter Brittany Patterson. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
I wanted to first start with sort of the Cliff Notes version of how it is that states ensure that coal mining operations are cleaned up. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's this supposedly relatively fail-safe system. You can kind of boil it down to almost a security deposit. You know, if you rent an apartment or an Airbnb or something, if you, the mining company, are going to mine, you make money available that should theoretically cover the cost of cleanup. If you walk away without cleaning up, the state has that money available. These are called bonds. And if you do your own cleanup, you get the money back like you would a security deposit. And kind of the second wrinkle to this is there's six states, mainly in Appalachia, that have a separate bond pool. That's kind of a pooled fund of extra money that's really supposed to back up these bonds in case an individual company abandons or forfeits its permits and mines.
So these coal companies that are taking out these bonds, they do them with something called a surety policy. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that means?
So there's a few different ways to bond. After a string of bankruptcies hit the major coal companies in 2015, 2016. A lot of them shifted to what are called surety policies, which are very similar to an insurance policy, and they're backed by insurance companies and reinsurance companies. So essentially, it says, hey, if the coal company, like I said, walks away, there's this third party. In the case of a surety, that means the third party is usually a large insurance company that's on the hook for the actual task of cleanup. So that's the backfilling of pits. That's the, you know, cleaning up the land, revegetating, you know, X, Y, and Z. And because it's a third party, because it's that insurance company, that's supposedly the safest way to put up a bond to make sure that coal mine gets cleaned up.
So this recent piece that you published was really looking into basically how these backstops, both the surety policies and also the bond pools, are doing. And if they're sufficient to be able to handle this downturn in the coal industry that we see is just ongoing. Let's start first with the bond pools. What do we know?
You know, so we've known for a couple of years that these bond pools have been likely dangerous. So we've known that they already were taking on much too much risk without forcing companies to pay in. And that's because all the companies in the pool pay in and they think they only need to deal with one or two bankruptcies at a time. The problem is, you know, the laws around this were set up in the 70s and the 80s. You know, these are laws that had a coal industry that was a legitimate industry, whereas now, you know, we're seeing coal companies flee the market as fast as they can. So these are really from a different time period, and they're just no longer able to handle this, because we're talking not about one company going under, two companies going under. We're talking about an industry-wide rush to leave the market.
On the flip side of that, the surety companies, tell us a little bit about what experts you spoke to were telling you about their health right now, especially during this continued downturn.
So the sureties are interesting because they were supposed to be this kind of shining light in the coal cleanup world. They were supposed to be this great idea, but they were predicated again on an industry that was worth something, that was worth money, an industry that insurance companies could come in and give these policies and actually make money off the premiums. The problem is large insurance companies are full of very smart math nerds. They're full of people that do the math and, you know, and see when their policies, when the risk to whatever you're bringing in via premiums isn't balancing. And so in the past few years, you've had a lot of these large insurance companies that used to back these providers and were safe. You know, they could handle bankruptcies because they were worth billions and billions of dollars. They're all leaving the market. They're realizing that the calculus isn't there anymore. And so the little bit of money that they would make, it doesn't really change their business, but the risk they would take on, the hundreds of millions of dollars in cleanup liability that we now know is headed their way, didn't make sense. So they're leaving the market. All we have left is a handful of smaller companies that are gobbling up all of this business from these really risky operators, the Jim Justices, the Jeff Hoops, Tom Clarks of the world, these largely private coal barons who are highly risky, are highly at risk of going under, which means all of this money, all of this liability would have to come from a small number of insurance providers. And so in the story, I liken it to the 2008 financial crisis and some of the subprime, you know, tranches of mortgages that went under. It's too much risk backed by a small number of people that don't have the money to clean it up. You know, I had several sources just call this a house of cards, and I don't really disagree with them at all, because we're seeing just kind of the writing on the wall for all the different ways of guaranteeing coal mine cleanup.
So what is at stake here?
That's a great question. Glad you asked it. So what's at stake here is hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, depending you know, on how you do the calculus, of coal cleanup costs. And those costs, you know, we passed federal legislation in 1977. We passed state laws, you know, after that as well, saying the coal companies will get this cleaned up. You know, they're using a public resource. They're making money off of it. It's up to them to make sure the environmental liability and the associated water pollution and air pollution, all of these things that come with it, are cleaned up by the people that made money off of it. You and I didn't make money off of it as taxpayers, so it's not our job to clean it up. The problem is, if this system collapses, and it won't totally collapse, there are still bonds, there are still these bond pools, but the difference between how much money is available and how much money we need is likely billions of dollars. And our options at that point will be either taxpayers pay billions of dollars for cleanup for private companies, or we don't clean up these mines.
That was Mark Holliday speaking with Brittany Patterson. You can find a link to his most recent reporting on our website, wvpublic.org. The pandemic has changed how worship happens in churches and synagogues. It's also affected how Muslims worship. To learn more about how COVID-19 has affected this community, reporter Kyle Vass went to a mosque in Huntington, West Virginia, to see what a return to worship looks like and how COVID-19 has impacted their services. He produced this story during the final week of Ramadan in May.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu
Akbar. Majid Qadr is singing the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. Qadr is used to large crowds because on Fridays, this room in his mosque can have hundreds of people crammed in shoulder to shoulder, all kneeling on the red carpeted floor, praying together. But today, the ornate red prayer carpet has a new pattern on it, white X's made from masking tape. These X's are set 6 feet apart to ensure people follow social distancing.
In normal days, we can have 250 to 300 individuals in the mosque. But now, I guess the maximum we can have is 35.
Before Omar Atarabian could even set foot inside the mosque today, he had to put on a mask and have his temperature taken at the door. He's a professor from Jordan and attends services here at the Huntington Mosque. Today's prayer normally would be an hour long, but it's cut short to only 15 minutes in an effort to minimize potential exposure to the coronavirus.
We're slowly getting back to normal. As you see, we have to maintain a 6 feet distance between individuals who come to pray.
He says even though things are returning to normal, only having a fraction of his fellow congregates around feels strange.
The social aspect of the prayer, you know, seeing people, seeing friends, seeing, you know, people that you know every single week, which is a great thing, but now it's just different. We lack that sensation. We don't have the same thing.
The traditions during Ramadan were especially different this year. Most Muslims fast from sunup to sundown, so they look forward to the end of the day when they can get together and have dinner with their friends and family.
We used to have a community dinner. People, we used to invite people to come and eat.
Salim Salame is standing downstairs from the prayer room, holding a handful of fresh-cut mint. He plans on using it for his early morning tea tomorrow.
But this year, I have basically I eat with my family. Even my son, he's live in Michigan, he said he wants to come. I said, no, stay where you are, because basically it's not enjoyable, because the enjoyment to eat with people, you know, to feed people, to interact with people. But this one almost is gone.
But for some Muslims, the COVID-19 pandemic has given them a chance to get closer to God. Nazia Ahmed is a physician in Charleston, West Virginia.
In times of hardship, you increase your connection with God. You worship more, and that's where you get your strength from.
Ahmed says staying at home has given her more time to study the Quran with her children. According to Ahmed, the Quran reminds people to focus on the inevitable end of hardships like a pandemic.
There are various verses throughout the Quran which talk about, you know, how God will test you. Inna ma'al usri yusra. This is the sentence that with hardship is ease. Those who believe in that mighty power, we know that everything happens for a reason.
Unlike Huntington, the mosque or masjid in Charleston hasn't begun to reopen yet. And Ahmed says that the time away has made her love for the masjid stronger.
I know that we are all waiting. We have all learned to appreciate the masjid more because we haven't had it for so long, and especially in Ramadan. But, this pandemic, it has been unpredictable in many respects. I guess the next 3-4 weeks will tell us.
For now, Ahmed and her family will attend services online through the West Virginia Muslim Association. She'll continue studying the Quran with her children and praying 5 times a day from home. As for the call to prayer, Ahmed says she has her favorite adhan saved on YouTube. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Vass.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University.